This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here's what's coming up.
There's no clear path to having any of these abusers stop being in power that has led them to the ability to conduct the abuses.
That was Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director Nicole Weldsham on the latest U.S. State Department report on human rights abuses around the globe. Also, Nigeria media report 21 people were killed in Saturday's elections, while police rescued 17 kidnapped election officials. And several hundred supporters of Tunisia President Kais Saied rallied in support of his government. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. In its annual report today on human rights practices, the U.S. State Department looked at violations and abuses in 198 countries and territories based on what the U.S. calls credible reports in 2022. The report is required to be submitted to Congress each year. The State Department highlighted what it calls massive deaths and destruction during Russia's war against Ukraine, accusing Russian forces of committing war crimes and other atrocities. It also reports cases of abuse and violations in Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Sudan. Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director Nicole Weldsham tells VOA's Caro Van Dam that while the report is thorough, the U.S. has not done enough to follow up on cases of rights abuses with action, especially regarding the military rulers in Sudan, who staged a coup in October 2021.
They have worked out an agreement that we're going to see the details of very soon that keep them in power. And it puts them on a transitional track to civilian leadership that, call me a cynic, but I've worked on Sudan for over 20 years. That is going to, like, the devil will be in the time, in the details. They're only committing themselves to transitioning themselves out of power. Now, they transitioned once out of power, and then they took it back in a coup in 2021. So I can't see, there's no clear path to having any of these abusers stop being in power that has led them to the ability to conduct the abuses. There's all impunity across the board in Ethiopia, in Sudan. South Sudan has worked so effectively to basically dissolve something they agreed to, the hybrid court on war crimes, to hold themselves accountable and to stop the cycle of impunity. And so all they want to talk about is reconciliation while the violent abuses continue. And those that oversaw the abuses in the South Sudanese government still stay in power. And they talk kind of illustratively about an election where they'll also transition to civilian power. And everybody just keeps these things on the horizon. And we're setting up the same path for Sudan. You commit now to having a transition to civilian elections, civilian government through elections at some point, some arbitrary date in the future, and you continue with these abuses and impunity and control over the economy and everything else.
What would Human Rights Watch like to see happen in those kinds of incidences with South Sudan, Sudan, Ethiopia?
The State Department Human Rights Report that was released today gives the U.S. government yet another chance to say, we know what's happening, and we will hold those that do these grave human rights abuses and atrocity crimes accountable in our policy. So there's a whole variety of tools that they can do that. They can do that with sanctioning individuals. They can put travel restrictions on individuals. They can freeze bank accounts if any of these individuals that are committing crimes hold their money in U.S. dollars anywhere. They can keep certain UN mechanisms and do the diplomatic spade work that we create a diplomatic coalition that keeps these UN mechanisms that monitor human rights, like in Ethiopia and elsewhere, in place. So we continue to expose the truth, and the U.S. government's at the forefront of that. There's things that they can do with they're a permanent member of the Security Council. They can look at the UN levers and tools, and they can really marriage and institutionalize the information they know and the abuses they are documenting by the people that they're working with into their regional policies and their foreign policies on these countries.
That was that's Nicole Weldsham, Human Rights Watch Washington Deputy Director and African expert. She was speaking with my colleague Caro Van Dam. Election observers and rights activists in Nigeria say Saturday's gubernatorial elections were marred by widespread violence and voter suppression, especially in Lagos. Nigerian media report 21 people were killed and scores injured, while police rescued 17 election officials kidnapped in the southeast Imo state. Despite glitches and delays, Nigeria's Minister of Information called it the most credible election in two decades. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
So far, Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, has declared results for 12 states, including the economic hub of Lagos, where incumbent Governor Babajide Sanwo-Olu of the ruling party was re-elected. But observers say Saturday's elections were characterized by widespread violence, voter suppression, and intimidation. Local media reported that 21 people were killed and scores injured across the country. In Imo State, police rescued 17 INEC staffers abducted by gunmen on the morning of the elections as they were heading to their polling units. Rights group Amnesty International condemned the violence. Aminu Hayatu is Amnesty International's conflict researcher.
There are pockets of violence, the prevention of people to make their choices in the ballot, disrupting electoral processes, and campaign of calumny, and the employment of thugs. We strongly condemn such human rights violations.
Amnesty International said social media was used to incite tribal hatred and ethnic slurs and urged social media companies like Twitter, Meta, and WhatsApp to improve their screening out of hateful content. There were also issues of staff delays and technical difficulties during Saturday's polls. But Nigeria's Information Minister, Lai Mohammed, who voted in his hometown in southwest Kwara State, said the election was one of the most credible in Nigeria's recent history. Idayat Hassan, director at the Center for Democracy and Development, disagrees and says the trend is worrying.
The likelihood of post-election violence are high, but how widespread is what we do not know. And considering this is a projection, the response of the state is what we should actually be looking up to. How will the Nigerian state be able to timely expect that they nip any form of insecurity challenges in the bud with the minimum use of force?
Kano State authorities have imposed a dusk to dawn curfew in anticipation of unrest as more results are announced. Amnesty International wants authorities to identify and punish promoters of election violence.
Such are violations against the international human rights law, which Nigeria is signatory to. And we are calling on government, to investigate and fish out those who are behind such human rights violations, irrespective of who they are.
Last month, observers said the presidential election in which the ruling party's Bola Ahmed Tinubu was declared the winner lacked transparency and didn't meet the expectations of most citizens. Experts say there's heightened tension in many states, including Adamawa State, where incumbent Governor Ahmadu Fintiri of the People's Democratic Party and Senator Aishatu Ahmed Binani of the All Progressives Congress are locked in a tough race. Ahmed Binani is the first woman with a realistic chance of being elected governor in Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
French journalist Olivier Dubois and American aid worker Jeffrey Wood have been released after being kidnapped by jihadists in the Sahel. Dubois spent 2 years in captivity and Wood 6, as Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
The two men were released Monday and are now in safe hands in Niger's capital, Niamey, according to media reports. Dubois was kidnapped on April 8, 2021, in Mali's northern Gao region by the Group for the Support of Islam and Muslims, or JNIM, a coalition of jihadist insurgent groups active in the Sahel. He was there to interview a jihadist leader when he was abducted. In a video posted to Twitter, he appeared to be in good condition and in good spirits. He told reporters he was tired but felt fine. It's huge for me to be here, to be free, he says. I'd like to acknowledge Niger and their expertise with this sensitive mission, and to France as well, to everyone that allowed me to be here today. American aid worker Jeffrey Woodkey has also been released after 6.5 years in captivity. Woodkey was kidnapped in October 2016 from his home in Abalak, Niger, and is believed to have been taken to Mali. Niger's interior minister said Nigerian authorities secured his release from JNIM, which is active throughout West Africa and the Sahel. Via Twitter, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said he was gratified and relieved over Woodkey's liberation and thanked Niger for its help in securing his release. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Niger last Thursday. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Police fired tear gas today at opposition supporters in Nairobi who are protesting against President William Ruto, the government, and the high cost of living. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called for the protests. For more on the protest, I reached Herman Manyora, a political analyst and professor at the University of Nairobi.
The protests in Kenya are regrettable. It's a sad day, and this sort of thing interferes with the peace in the country. It does interfere with business and with the lives of citizens, interrupts many things. Children who are going to school today after midterm break, it is something that must be avoided at all costs. It's not good for the country.
And apart from Kenya, there have been protests across the continent in Tunisia, in South Africa, and some had been planned in Senegal. Are Africans finding their voice, or as you say, is disruptive?
These are disruptive things, and African leaders must learn that we are in the 21st century. We live in a century and times when leadership is negotiated, when you must dialogue with your people, have a conversation as a people. Whenever issues arise, and indeed there will always be issues, leaders must learn to sit down with their opponents in the manner admirably shown by President Samia Suluhu of Tanzania, who has invited opposition in a series of meetings to sort out the problems facing the country and find a way of dealing with Tanzanian problems. But African leaders must go in that direction. He's just thumping and saying, I cannot talk to anybody. I am the president or I'm the opposition leader. I must have my way. It has no room for the 21st.
Professor, protests and demonstrations haven't been tolerated in the past. And even when they are, not much has been gotten from them, apart from the Arab Spring. They have not borne results. Do you think this time across the continent, the governments will respond to the people's demands?
I don't think that is true of Kenya. A lot of what we have achieved in this country has been achieved through the struggle. People have been in the trenches from the 80s and 90s during the Second Liberation. Almost everything we have today in terms of human rights, democracy, good governance, and a little development that we have achieved surely has been achieved through struggle, through demonstrations, through all manner of pushing. And for us, really, you cannot say it has not borne results. For Kenya, no. For Kenya, demonstrations, mass action, actually, these sort of things have produced results. I also think even this one, if you are in a room today at the leader of the year, this is not the sort of thing you can ignore if you are government. It's not possible. It's not possible because the disruptions are mass. The turnout, the people facing the police, the defiance, really turning Nairobi into a ghost town or a war zone, alternating between a ghost town with no people into a war zone. I don't think any president would be proud to sit in the State House or White House or whatever you call your residence for the president and ignore what's going on. So ultimately, those who refuse to talk today will be forced to talk tomorrow. And that's what I would say. It's not a journey Africans should travel, not at a time we must develop our economy. We must feed our people. We must create jobs for our people. So it is hardly the time you'd want to engage in this sort of thing that's actually counterproductive.
That was Professor Herman Manyora of the University of Nairobi. He spoke with me from Nairobi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Several hundred supporters of Tunisia President Kais Saied rallied today in support of his government. Elected in 2019, Saied has consolidated power by shutting down parliament and rewriting the constitution, saying he was trying to save the country from years of political chaos and economic stagnation. His government has cracked down on dissent, detaining politicians, union figures, judges, business leaders, and the head of an independent radio station. Reuters says hundreds of pro-Saied protesters marched in central Tunis today, chanting, "The people of the country want to be cleansed." They also denounce what they call foreign interference and attacks on Tunisian sovereignty by the U.S. and the European Union, who are criticizing Saied's crackdown on opponents. Meanwhile, the Tunisian opposition is already preparing for next year's presidential election, even though many of its leaders have been imprisoned for allegedly voting against state security. President Kais Saied's moves to bolster his power, including dissolving municipal courts last week, have caused the World Bank to suspend future engagement talks with Tunisia. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi discussed with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, whether united opposition can force a return to some sort of democratic transition in Tunisia.
Eventually, yes, but not quite yet, for several reasons. First of all, early after the coup, the army, many civil society organizations, and one of the 10 largest parties and some other minor parties that had no seats in government were supporting the president's coup and created the space for him to impose this new system on the Tunisian people that he designed basically himself. That happens because Tunisians were exhausted by COVID, hit hard by the economic crisis caused by COVID, and then by the many other global factors that hit many other countries, and decided to blame the entire political class and were supporting early on a savior figure who had come in to save them. They have gradually figured out that this gentleman is not interested in economics, which was his main proposal to support his coup, and that he's really only interested in this utopian political vision doomed to failure. And so the quasi-totality of civil society now and all the political parties are opposed to him, but they feel they can't do anything yet if the army is still supporting him. And they have yet to turn out large numbers in the street. I think the largest protests we've had are in the 10 to 20,000 range. And many analysts, including myself, agree that until larger numbers of Tunisians, 50,000, 60,000 are out in the street, the army is unlikely to budge and he'll be able to hang on to power against these nonviolent protests. There's another scenario, which that's the economic crisis becomes much worse and the majority of Tunisians who care more about economics than politics decide to riot and raise havoc and take more radical or revolutionary actions, in which case you might have the army or powers that be turn against the president as destabilizing. But for now, the exhaustion and the relative passivity of the Tunisian population in the face of the economic crisis has allowed him to hang on. It's not that the opposition isn't unified, they are now. It's that they're not turning out large numbers in the streets that would force things the other way. And the president is using that exhaustion, that passivity to his advantage.
The World Bank has temporarily suspended its future engagement talks with Tunisia amid uproar over recent statements by President Kais Saied against African migrants. The two sides were engaged in talks for providing Tunisia with loans up to $520 million. How could the behavior of the president complicate the Tunisian economic crisis?
It's doing it on a daily basis. Let's understand that we have had a nationwide violence against dark-skinned Tunisians, whether legal migrants, refugees, the 8,000 African students in Tunisia who have been beaten, robbed, evicted, and are living in fear to the point that Tunisian friends of mine are distributing food to them in their homes because they're afraid to leave them, if they're even able to stay in their homes. Others are congregating outside, UNHCR and international organizations, or they've been evacuated by plane by their home governments in one of the most awful racist moments in North Africa that I'm aware of in modern history. It's atrocious. It's fascistic language the president used in his February 21st address based on the Tunisian Nationalist Party's rhetoric, which is fascist. And he's doing this apparently in part to distract Tunisians from the political crackdown that's going on, in which he's arresting many opposition figures, any of his critics that are outspoken, and the Tunisians that tried to convene a national dialogue to get Tunisia out of the political crisis. They're all in jail. So this is a turn for the worse. There's no focus on economics. The World Bank is shocked. The African Union has been increasingly shocked. The African Union, which had already deemed the president's actions a coup. And now the World Bank has not suspended all programs, but it suspended forward programs, the discussions towards the next round of programs. And the IMF has not come through with its $1.9 billion bailout loan for Tunisia, not because of the racist actions of Tunisia yet, although they're also expressing concern, but because Tunisia is just not paying attention to economics and isn't even filling out the paperwork related to the deal they've already argued.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi held talks on Sudan with high-ranking Russian officials to discuss a Russian-built nuclear power plant, grain supplies and food security. Reuters says the meeting included Russia's trade minister and a special envoy of President Vladimir Putin. They also addressed establishment of a Russian industrial zone inside the Suez Canal's economic zone, among other investments. Russia is building Egypt's first nuclear power plant at El Dada, which is expected to begin operations in 2030. Reuters says Cairo is also depending more heavily on Russia for wheat imports since Moscow's war in Ukraine disrupted purchases from Kyiv. Zambian authorities have arrested the country's Auditor General and 17 others at the Ministry of Finance on charges of corruption and theft of public funds. The suspects allegedly benefited from $25 million in payments for fictitious activities. Cather Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
Anti-Corruption Commission spokesperson Timothy Mono confirmed the arrest to reporters in Lusaka on Friday. Mono says the commission is not targeting any one person at the finance ministry.
The commission has subsequently restricted several bank accounts held by individuals suspected to be involved in this saga as part of ongoing investigation.
The investigations stemmed from a special audit of the government's financial management information system for the period from 2018 to 2021. Secretary to the Cabinet Patrick Kangwa, in an earlier statement, said that President Hagainde Hichilema has directed that the ongoing investigations must be concluded without any interference. Transparency International's representative in Zambia, Sam Pakalunga, recently complained on a local radio station the government's anti-corruption program is disjointed, archaic, and does not show results. Many previous arrests have ended in bail, with defendants denying the charges and investigations not resulting in any convictions. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer tonight, Cornelius Timrum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.